The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
When Rory McIlroy made the career high achievement of becoming one of only six people to get the career Grand Slam when he won the Masters, a lot of people reacted to it. The US President reacted, the British King, and of course the Irish Taoiseach. And what the Irish Taoiseach said was that it reminded him of that the nation holds its breath moment. Now, the nation holds its breath moment is now 35 years, just on the, coming up on a 35th birthday. It was provided to us by George Hamilton, who is here. George, there's very few people who will say something that will be remembered by the afternoon or next week. You must be chuffed to have the Taoiseach quoting you, well, 35 years on.
It brought me up short. I was quite shocked, actually, because it was my sister-in-law who sent me a text. You never believe what's just happened. And I couldn't believe it. It's quite astonishing, really, because it's not something that you ever expect to happen. You don't say something in the hope that it will resonate forever. In the context of that quotation, it was said to match a moment in time. That moment in time turned out to be particularly significant. But if we spool back just a little bit, if Paddy Bonner hadn't made the save, David O'Leary's kick would have a different connotation, and the nation would have been holding his breath for keeping in the contest to equalise the goal that the penalty that had gone in. But because Paddy made the save, he enabled that moment to happen. And it's kind of funny how, you know, it's a sliding doors moment almost.
How much of those in advance, those kind of phrases, do you bottle up and keep for high tension moments, or is it all ad lib as you go through?
It's all ad lib, but the ad lib can come shortly before the moment, if you know what I mean. That something will strike you that if this continues in the way that it's going, it would be appropriate to say this, but you don't actually say it unless what happens, happens. But that particular one just came to me in the moment because I'd been told that the 6-1 News was taking the pictures as well as the Network 2, as it was, coverage that I was involved in. And so I was really aware that if anybody was watching television, Irish television, on that day, the only picture they could see was this. So it had to be the audience was the country. And it was a very significant moment because this was Ireland at the World Cup for the first time, about to get into the last eight if he converts it. And it just came to me that everywhere the people were watching television, this was what they were seeing.
That means that you must have had one of the largest television audiences for your voice that anybody has ever had in the history of the state. It does. If you're 6-1 and if you're back in the day when there wasn't a multiplicity of channels.
That's right. There were only the two. I mean, TV3 didn't come along until what was 1998, 8 years later. So yes, 6-1 was a television by appointment, of course. And if you weren't interested in the football, well, you were certainly interested in the news. So it was virtually everybody was watching television at that time, I guess so, yeah.
The other thing I think about in your commentary career is it was sort of, it was era-defining beyond sport, because that period from sort of Euro 88 up to the early 90s, it was the first time that we were ever internationally good at anything, really. We sort of take for granted now the rugby team might give it a shot at the World Cup, but back then we weren't useful at anything at all. And it was the start of that Celtic Tiger period, the change in Ireland. And whenever you do a reeling in the years, whenever it's reflected on it, it is your voice that's associated most, I think.
Well,
with that period,
that's very kind of you to say it. But I got lucky. I mean, I came back to work in Dublin at the end of 1984, and Jack Charlton was appointed at the beginning of 1986, and that took off. Football took off in a way that it hadn't. I mean, his predecessor Owen Hand came so close, but just couldn't get them qualified, and then Jack came along, and it was almost by default, because they didn't qualify by themselves for Euro 88. It took Scotland to score an unlikely victory in Bulgaria to send them to Germany, West Germany as it was. And that kind of took everybody by surprise because of the nature of it, the nature of the qualification, and the fact, oh, goodness gracious, we're in a tournament. So that by the time the World Cup came around 2 years later, everybody was on board and there was this great rolling wave that I was able to surf.
Did you know you were surfing that wave at the time? Did you recognise the scale of how notable it was, how significant it was? Did it feel that way when you're in it?
It did feel very, very significant. And I'll tell you why. Because Ireland, by its nature, is quite inward-looking, and we all know where we come from. And so we express ourselves through a loyalty to the parish and the county, and it's county colours that are worn everywhere. And then all of a sudden, but not to the extent of Italy, in Germany in 88, there were green shirts. And it struck me that this was the first time that Irish people had the opportunity to wear a green shirt abroad and say, hey, I'm Irish and my team is here. So when they played the three matches in Germany in an 18 tournament, got knocked out, but by the two teams who went on to contest the final, then suddenly Jack Charlton's Ireland meant something. Meant something significant. And when they qualified for the World Cup, well, then everybody was on board and everybody who went was wearing green shirts. And the big thing, Anton, about going to a tournament, the Swedes all turn up in yellow, the Dutch wear orange boiler suits, now there's Irish green as well. And it was absolutely fabulous. So to that extent, I was aware that this was very, very significant, but not to the extent that it was how significant it was going to become, that Jack was only on the upward trajectory that was going to take him to almost 10 years in the job, which would be unheard of now. And I don't think will ever happen again. So it was hindsight, 2020 vision. Yes, of course. But it was building incrementally when you were in it. It wasn't, oh gosh, this is the moment.
And for you, were you always a mad sports fan, or do you see yourself as broadcaster primarily that happens to do it in a sports avenue?
No, when I look back at where I came from, it was always going to be sport, even though there was no way in to a full-time sports career until basically I joined RTE for the first time in 1979. I was working in current affairs and news because sport was kind of an add-on. And it wasn't possible. Now, of course, there are sports departments that are populated by tens of maybe dozens of people, but then that was not the case. I mean, how I came to go to Argentina for my first World Cup was because RTE didn't have the personnel to send. They had two commentators. They had Jimmy McGee, they'd Philip Green. They wanted to send four because Argentina was, the venues were spread out and they reckoned they needed four commentators on the ground. So they had their two. They hired Billy George from what was then the Cork Examiner. And then the head scratching started. And Mike Horgan, the late Mike Horgan, who was a senior editor in there, great guy. Mike, I can just hear him saying, oh, what about the chap up the road in Belfast? And so Fred Cogley sent me a letter. That's how it happened, a letter. And it said, would you consider?
Which you said, I'll have your arm off, I assume.
Exactly,
is the response.
Exactly. But that's how it happened. You know, there was no career in sport to be had back then.
Was there anybody to model yourself on back then?
Well, I modelled myself as a kid on Kenneth Wilson, home of the BBC, who was the voice of football. He was the first on Match of the Day when it started in the early 60s. He was their principal commentator through my adolescence. So if I fancied this as a career, which looking back, I clearly did, Kenneth Wolstenholme was the role model. But it was very interesting. Kenneth Wolstenholme brought out a memoir subsequently, and there was, the memoir was balanced between his career as a broadcaster and his service in World War II in the Royal Air Force, Britain's Royal Air Force. And it was more about the RAF than it was about Kenneth Wolstenholme, the commentator. And I was quite disappointed in that. Fascinating read, but nonetheless, it didn't tell me all that I wanted to know about the career that he had. But
what had he been in the Air Force? Was he a pilot?
I can't recall what he was in the Air Force, but he saw active service, so he must have been a pilot.
So the ones then who would have been not quite your contemporaries because they would have been a generation earlier, there were some absolute legends. I mean, there was Murray Walker, there was Bill McLaren. Mm. Who for you was the sort of the zenith of the art?
Well, here's Bill McLaren, you mention. Here's the story about Bill McLaren. When I did my first commentary, it was rugby because they had too many people who wanted to do football and did football. So there was no in for me in rugby. But it happened that a British and Irish Lion, Sammy Walker.
You were from a rugby school though, weren't you?
I was, yes. Yeah. Which irked me as well that I couldn't play football. But Sammy Walker, the late Sammy Walker, a British and Irish Lion, was the commentator on BBC Northern Ireland. And then he died and a chap called Tom Crummy took it on. But Tom Crummy was a senior civil servant and he worked in the Department of the Community Relations of all things. And in the early 70s, that was a pretty serious job. And Tom Crummy, when I appeared on the scene, said, if that lad's doing commentary, I think I'll step back because, you know, my life is full. And while I love doing it, it's really too much taking weekends away, you know, four weekends in the course of the Five Nations, which involved coming down to Dublin or going to the other venue, wherever it was. So I got the call in the season of the spring of 74. And my first match was Ireland-Scotland in Lansdowne Road. And on the day before, those days we'd come down on a Thursday and swan it in the Shelburne Hotel.
That's the way to do it, George.
The broadcasting organisations had money, you know. And so down I came with my producer, Joy Williams, who went on to become the BBC's first female head of sport. And Joy was a very gregarious lady who knew everybody. So Friday morning, we might walk down Kildare Street to College Park to see the Scots run out, what they now call the captain's run, and it would take place in the stadium. But back then, these guys were running around on the rugby pitch in College Park, the back of Trinity. And we went in, and there were a few people watching, and I recognised in a group of people this tall figure with a shock of black hair, Bill McLaren, and Joy spotted him too. She said, "There's Bill, come on, darling, we'll go." And Joy took me to introduce me to Bill McLaren. I said, no, Bill doesn't want to meet me. But Joy introduced me to Bill, who was with some other people. And Bill was a great man for the Hoyt Balls, little boiled sweets. And the first thing he did was take the bag of sweets out of his pocket and offer a sweet. So that I was now in the company. And then he said, "Joy tells me this is your first one." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Come with me," and he excused himself from the company, and he took me down the touchline, and he basically gave me a tutorial in commentary, and he pointed out, I remember these distinctly, the two centres, Jim Rennick and Ian McGeachan, and he said, "They won't always oblige you by turning their number towards you. You've got to kind of recognise them in the way you'd recognise your best friend if he turned the corner down the street, because everybody has a way of moving." But the clue with Rennick and McGeachan is also that McGeachan is the one with the hair, Rennick's bald. So the Scots, that was the Scots' back sorted out for me. And then he pulled from his pocket his dope sheet for the day, for the match. And it was four...
His dope sheet.
That's what it's called. Yeah. Commentary notes, yeah. And he had four A4 pages sellotaped together. The teams were at top centre, and then colour-coded, the multicoloured pens. He had filled in these four sheets with minute writing, and it was every conceivable fact and figure. And I said, "My goodness, that's like a work of art." He says, "Yeah, I sit down, I open it up and I put it in front of me and I do the commentary." I said, "How would you ever get all that in?" He said, "I won't." He said, "I'll only use 5% of that, but I won't know which 95% to junk until it's all over." And that was Bill McLaren. So that's a very long-winded answer to your
question. Did you lift that approach?
I did. That's how I learned to prep for matches. And it evolved over the years. And as I've got older and slower, my commentary sheet, my dope sheet, isn't as full of all the words. It's become almost like my own personal shorthand. I know what it means. When I'm doing a Champions League or a Europa League match, I note the scorers in that competition in green. And that tells me instantly who has scored. So if Hoyland of Manchester United has 5 goals in the Europa League, there's a little green 5 on my sheet beside his name. I don't need to put 5 Europa League because I know what that means. And similar, and there's blue for extraneous facts, and there's red for the must knows, like age, nationality, caps. That's
sellotape together.
No, I just use one sheet.
That's how you know when you've really made the absolute best. One sheet. The one thing that I've mentioned that, though, is how do you know when to shut up? Because I mentioned earlier on the McIlroy victory at the Masters. Mm. One of the things that I thought was notable in the commentary of that was the guys did a lovely job in long periods of silence, so you could just feel the tension coming. But I assume, you know, it's like the thing of if all you have is a hammer, you know, the world looks like a nail. If you're paid to talk, there must be a huge urge to say, "I better fill this silence."
Well, actually, there isn't, because you are aware when you are the third part of the two-dimensional picture that this picture is what's driving the thing. So it's like everything else. If it's not good, you'll know it's not good. It's like the bad referee who gets in the way. Extraneous facts that have no relevance to the moment disrupt. So if you go into a riff, I mean, it happened to me with the danger here quote, when the ball was with the Russian goalkeeper, the Soviet goalkeeper in Hanover in Euro 88. And I started going on about, from him, I took the line to Packy Bonner and started going on about Packy Bonner's magnificent recent record of not having conceded a goal. And during this time, the ball was moving from left to right through the Russian midfield until it reached Oleg Protasov, who was in a shooting position, at which point I cut short my narrative and said, danger here! And a goal was scored. So there, that kind of sums up how you don't do it, because the picture is driving it, and you are there to complement the picture. And that you'll find in that nation holds his breath moment that there were silences built into that as well. And there's also, as your colleague Pat Kenny described it, a choreography about television coverage. So in the context of a penalty, you'll have a close-up of the taker, you'll have a wide shot and a close-up of the goalkeeper. You know what's coming, in other words. You'll know when there's going to be a close-up or when there's going to be a wide shot.
And that to some extent, I wonder, impinged on your art in that... When you would have started, you had relatively limited camera positions and relatively limited camera technology. Now you have drone shots, you've got the dolly rigs flying across over the... You can pretty much get into the big close-ups of players mid-action. Does that make it more difficult to commentate on, or does that take some of the pressure off because people can see more clearly what's occurring?
Well, it probably makes it... that bit more difficult because people can't see so much more of it. But by the same token, you adapt. I mean, you're at it to match the picture. And if the picture has changed, technology has created all these different types of image, you react to that. And there are times when you don't. I mean, the picture does tell the story. And it's amazing when you think you haven't talked enough. And you listen back and you realise that actually it worked because the picture was telling the story.
What do people say to you when they bump into you in the street, and how annoying does it become getting your own words said back to you for three decades?
It doesn't get annoying at all. Because
really?
No, really, because I find it, my wife Linda has a great word for it, it's affirmation. You know, it affirms that You must have done something right. And it's not that they're saying, why did you say that? It's that they're taking pleasure out of recalling the moment. And it was a very hugely significant moment for everybody. And it put Ireland, the Irish football team, into a place that they'd never been before. And it might be some time before we ever get the chance to appear in the last eight of the World Cup. It's so far distant. It was a moment in time, and it was a very significant moment in time, and it's very gratifying to have had the opportunity to be associated with it.
George, you're a gentleman for coming in. If you want to hear George, you can hear him on Lyric FM doing a regular gig with the Today Show, analysing music. Because is it cellist originally? Is that what you were?
I was a pianist. I consider myself a pianist. I did all the exams in piano. That led, because I could read the bass clef, to playing the cello in the school orchestra, which I did for 6 years. But I'm not. I don't consider myself a cellist per se because I don't have a cello. I have two pianos, a guitar and a banjo.
Well, established guitarist, banjo player and pianist, George Hamill. George, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anton.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.